Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Today is April 28th. I am so pleased to welcome Hannah Brame to the show. She's the author of a book called The Ultimate Guide to Journaling. And journaling, of course, is an indispensable part of the self-knowledge, self-improvement, personal growth process, which is ongoing, as many of us have learned. So we're going to talk about the book. We're going to tell you about how to get the book. We are going to discuss our own experiences with journaling. There's going to be tips, and I think you're going to get a lot out of this one. Tons of good information in this show. Brett, why do you sound like you're in a bathroom? Okay, so time for announcements then, because that's a good question. Why do I suddenly sound like I'm recording in a bathroom? There is no acoustic foam on the walls right now, and this is the beginning of a story that leads to an announcement. I have taken everything apart in this room except exactly what I need to record this brief podcast intro. Now, some of you who have a better ear might be saying, Brett, I think you needed that acoustic foam because it sounds like you're talking into an old metal sand pail. I get that. This is going to be quick. So here it is. I am a renter. I do not own. I am in a lease. I am mid-lease right now. There is an opportunity for me to move to a larger unit on the same property, which I need, and I'm doing it in a couple of days. So I am going to take roughly 10 days off from doing almost anything related to the show except one very awesome thing. Once I am in this bigger place, I will be reunited with the one thing that is missing from this studio, the one thing that I need to tie everything together, and that is the boomerang. What is the boomerang, Brett? I'm new. So, backstory. In 2012, we were using the LRN Manchester studio, and I was trying to do video in there, but I couldn't get any good shots because the table was too small. And I said on the air one night, this table is really cramping our style. Within weeks, I was contacted by a carpenter. His name was Chris Wolf. This glorious motherfucker built to my specifications a beautiful boomerang-shaped table. The legs of this table are brushed metal anarchy symbols. The table has a hatch in the middle that drops down, allowing people to walk through the center of the table. Because the table is so large that walking all the way around it is almost inconvenient. And since this table's triumphant birth in 2012, it has been at Dale's studio because I've never had a place large enough to put it until now. It is the greatest table in the history of the Liberty Movement. Well, that's quite a thing to say. But I've seen the other tables in the Liberty Movement, and I know its history. Once the table is in place, I will rebuild the studio around it. I don't want to make it sound like the table is why I'm moving, but it's the best part of the fact that I'm moving. There are other good parts too. So give me 10 days, huh? And then we'll start hitting it hard again with some new stuff. I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about the future of the Liberty Movement, starring my boomerang table. So that's it, everybody. I would really like your feedback on the show. This is a super important topic. We're going to be exploring it more in the future. You're also going to hear me mention a book that I'm currently working on called The Art of Self-Discovery. It is written by Nathaniel Brandon. It is a fantastic way to get acclimated to the journaling process. It is a fantastic way to discover all kinds of interesting things about yourself. And you can get the book for free on Wes Bertrand's site, happinesscounseling.com. When you get there, you just click on the resources tab and you will see a link to Honoring the Self by Nathaniel Brandon, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life by Marshall Rosenberg, Real-Time Relationships, The Logic of Love by Stefan Molyneux, and then you scroll down a little bit more and you will see The Art of Self-Discovery as a PDF. It's a workbook. This is work. Peace. I'm so pleased. I never gave up on it.
can also be a challenge if you've never tried it before. You might find it difficult to get started, maintain focus, or think of something to write about. The first few times I journaled, I felt very self-conscious, and part of me was incredibly cynical about the whole exercise. It might take a while for you to feel comfortable with your practice, and this process can be uncomfortable and frustrating. But if the initial challenges can be overcome, the benefits of journaling make any interim struggle totally rewarding. After all, it's worth some discomfort to have a better relationship with yourself and others, rather than to avoid the discomfort in the short term and never truly know yourself. If you feel resistance to journaling, try asking yourself the following questions. How do I feel when I think of journaling? Do I feel uncomfortable about the idea of sitting in a room alone? If so, what is the thought behind this discomfort? What challenges do I think might come up if I start journaling? Is there something in my current life or history that's difficult to think about and might contribute to resistance? If so, how could I approach this gently? How can I show compassion and empathy for myself during this process? Can I think of any potential blocks to this compassion, and how am I going to deal with that?
Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Brett. Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
It's great to have you. And I just finished The Ultimate Guide to Journaling that we're going to discuss today. But I also wanted to mention your website here at the top of the show. This looks like a fantastic resource, and I'm really excited to dig into it. It's called Becoming Who You Are, becomingwhoyouare.net. Can you tell us a little bit about what the goals are for this site?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for your kind words. I'm really glad that you're enjoying it. So the site is actually in a little bit of a transition at the moment. So where it's heading towards is really supporting people to have the courage to be fully self-expressed. So up until now, I've been focusing on self-kindness and developing a deeper and healthier and more fulfilling relationship with ourselves. I think there's a lot of focus in the world on our relationships with other people, which is super important. But that starts with our relationship with ourselves. So that's kind of what I've been focused on so far. And I'm currently in the middle of transitioning into talking more about what I consider to be the next step from that, which is then self-expression. And okay, well, once we've got this great relationship with ourselves, once we're working on our relationship with ourselves, what do we do with that? And I hope my aim is to encourage people and inspire people to go out into the world and to really share that with other people and share their gifts and their strengths and their vision and who they are.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of our themes in the show today when we talk about journaling or just this work in general. Like, we dig these things up, we look at them, then what do we do?
it's a good question.
When people are earlier along in this process, that can be a difficult thing to think about. And it can be even a bit of a demotivator, I think. You know, I've found myself on the road to greater self-knowledge for a long time. And there's been periods in my life where I'm kind of sitting at a rest stop and telling myself it's the destination or pretending it's the destination, but it isn't. And I recently heard Daniel Mackler say, hey, I've never really met anyone who was done with this journey. You know, whether it's laziness or frustration, it's easy to get off track. It's easy to, I think, for many of us to tell ourselves we're okay, we're healed, there's nothing else to see. The normalcy of life comes in to kind of fill in some holes that still might be there, and this comfort develops. So I think that the process of journaling and that continuous dialogue with ourselves is a great way to hopefully avoid some of those ruts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you raised so many really important points there. And the first one being that I share Daniel's view, and certainly it's been my experience. I'm not obviously very old, I'm in my late 20s, but so far what I found is that despite doing a lot of self-work, it's not a journey that really ever ends. And in some ways, that's kind of a good thing because it takes the pressure off. You know, there's no sense of like, well, you have to get to a certain point or anything like that. It's just an ongoing process. And wherever you're at in the journey is where you're at. I think it's actually, you know, I've known people who have reached a point where they have declared that they are done. And in my experience, it's kind of a dangerous place to be, because then we get complacent, then we do lose touch with ourselves, because we're not open to those experiences that you talked about, where life kind of throws us a curveball or something happens that brings up additional stuff for us. You know, if we feel this pressure to kind of be done with our journey and to have, quote, finished like self-knowledge or personal development, then we're not going to be very receptive to those experiences, and we're going to close off those parts of ourselves. So yeah, and journaling certainly for me has been like a super, super helpful tool when it comes to self-knowledge. I mean, I consider it a kind of combination of self-therapy and self-coaching. So yeah, I'd love to talk more about it today.
Absolutely. And just to jump on one of the things you said right there, we talk a lot and think a lot, and this comes through in the journaling as well, about this concept, or really this existence of this inner child. And you mention in the book, we grow up, many of us, most of us, I think, especially in school and at home, we grow up in a way where we kind of adapt unconsciously to quieting ourselves for the sake of acceptance or for the sake of being good. But that self still has a lot of things to say. And if we don't empathize with him or her, or if we don't listen to him or her, dare I say, even though it's not a word choice that I like, but I think it paints a picture, there can be an occasional tantrum, right? That that voice, because it still has things to say, can come back and say them in ways that are probably counterproductive in our adult lives. So
sure.
Yeah, and that being said, let's talk a little bit about this process. I was always convinced, and I think this is one of the things that took me off the tracks with journaling, I was always convinced that there had to be a fairly narrow criteria for doing this right. But there really isn't, right? In the first three chapters of the book, you illustrate that there are quite a lot of options here.
Absolutely. That was actually, I'm really glad you said that, because that was actually one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book in the first place. Because when I started journaling myself, and I did so as part of my own journey, I went through a very difficult time in my late teens, early 20s. And as part of sort of coming out of that, I started journaling as a way of, A, first of all, figuring out, like, who the hell am I? Like, what do I actually think about things? What do I actually feel about things? And then B, as you mentioned earlier, sort of, okay, well, what do I do with this now? Figuring out, well, what are the next steps in my life? What does this actually mean? And when I started, I had no freaking clue, if I can say that, what I was doing. I was convinced I was doing it quite wrong. I was looking for a guide that would tell me kind of how to do it, what to say, what to write and everything, which I think is more reflective of kind of where I was at that point, that I just wanted someone to sit me down and say, here's how you do it. But it was just a big question mark for me. And that was what I really learned through that experience. You know, in a way, I'm kind of grateful that I didn't have that guidance, because I think otherwise I would have tried to kind of pigeonhole myself into that structure rather than what I ended up doing, which was reading about it as much as possible, trying out all these different techniques, and really figuring out at the end that there is no right way to do journaling. Like, it really can be whatever you want it to be. Now at any one time, I have multiple journals that I keep, and they all have very different purposes and different formats. So I do free writing, which I talk about in the book, which is like the stream of consciousness writing. If any of your listeners are familiar with Julia Cameron and The Artist Way, it's similar to morning pages, which is the practice that she advocates, where you write 750 or three A4 pages stream of consciousness every morning. It's a great way of clearing your brain, getting to the root of what you're really thinking about, getting past your kind of unconscious mental defenses and so on. So I do that. I have a reading journal, which is literally just a list of books that I read and when I finish them. I have a business journal. I do weekly reviews for my business because I'm self-employed every week as well, which is a form of journaling for me, because it's a way of, you know, really, again, figuring out like, okay, what's going well, what's not going so well, what can I learn from this, what am I learning taking forward into next week and everything. And so I just use that as an illustration to show that there is no quite right or wrong way to journal. And I think it's such a great point to start with that you brought this up, because that is, in my experience, is what held me back from starting. And when I talk to people about journaling as well, when I have clients and I suggest journaling to them, because I'm a coach, that's sort of what I do by trade, the number one objection that comes up is, oh, well, I don't know how to do that. Like, how do you get started? And it sounds really simple, but it's like, you just write, and whatever is going to come up will come up, and then you can see where it takes you and go from there.
So it's really about getting a sense of what works for you, and you've found that it's actually multiple things.
Yeah, for sure. So, and I find also that, you know, I used to think that if I was going to, well, it's a question of integrity if I was going to write about a book about journaling, and if I was going to talk about journaling, then I needed to, you know, do my kind of journaling, which for most of my sort of journaling experience has been the stream of conscious journaling. I used to think that I needed to do that every single day. And what I found is that actually, not only do different types of journaling suit different areas of my life and are useful for different things in different areas of my life, but different journaling techniques and tools help me at different times in my life as well. So stream of consciousness journaling is not always the most helpful journaling for me. It's not always the most helpful thing. So again, you know, for anyone listening who's new to this or even is an experienced journaler, like, you don't need to kind of pigeonhole yourself into a certain type or technique of journaling. It's a very, very fluid process. And I think we can actually help ourselves a lot more and enjoy it a lot more, because that's important too. That's ultimately what's going to keep us going. If we can have a degree of flexibility and really be creative about it and think, well, what is going to be most helpful for me today? What do I feel like doing today? What's speaking to me today? And right. That's part of the reason why I've included so many different techniques in the book.
In the second chapter, you talk a little bit about frequency, and you've described your development process and trial and error. One of my listeners named Trevor had a couple of questions related to that. And, you know, I thought it was worth asking, because in preparation, I had actually pulled out a journal that I was keeping about 10 years ago. You know, I would see like the gaps in entries, and I would look at the things I wrote, and I would also, we can come back to this, but I would kind of evaluate an entry or a series of entries and say, well, how would this really be useful later? This is like a list of things that I did and not really much about how it affected me or how I felt. But most importantly was the consistency. And Trevor asks, how many times has she failed to keep on track? Or I guess we could change how many times to has that happened? And does she have any tips for developing a rhythm or a momentum?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Trevor. Thank you. And so I'm curious, I guess I would turn that around and ask, what does on track look like to you? Because for me, on track is a lifetime thing. So in terms of getting off track, I'm assuming by that you mean, how many times do I start, for example, a daily practice and then fall off the wagon, so to speak?
Yeah.
So I like frequently all the time. I think that's just I can't even count sort of remembering, because it's like anything in life, you know, we start with the best of intentions. We need to carry on. Sometimes things get in the way that frankly we could have avoided, but we didn't. Sometimes, you know, as I was saying, life throws us curveballs, etc. Sometimes we move on to other things that at the time feel like they're going to be more helpful. But I think the biggest lesson that I've learned through doing that is that it's not about how much you do in a day, a week, or a month. It's, you know, doing 5 minutes a day is better than doing like 70 minutes a week, right, in one go. So it's making any time that you can to do it consistently, and also remembering that it's a long-term game. You know, it's not a failure if you make a plan to do like journaling every day for the next 30 days or whatever, if you do a monthly challenge or anything like that. It's not a failure if you quit that. The most important thing is that you start again the next day.
Right.
Which you could say about anything in life, really, that you really, really want to do. It's not the falling off the wagon part. Yes, if you can avoid it, it's a good idea. If it happens, it's a good idea to go back and think, well, why did this happen? What got in the way? And so on and so forth. But I think the most important thing to focus on is not so much like when you fall off and why you fall off, but okay, when do I get back on?
Yeah.
And how can I avoid this again? So yeah, I mean, being completely honest, like I fall off frequently. And this is why now I think in the beginning, I actually found it really helpful to have a structure and to think, you know, I'm going to journal every day, especially when I was new to it, just because it helped me get past that kind of uncomfortable beginner phase that we all experience in anything that we do for the first time. And I'm sure you're aware of this, Brett, with your background, that as a society, we're kind of anti-beginner, right? We want to get past that stage as quickly as possible and get to the point where it's nice and comfortable and we can say to people, hey, look, I'm really good at this, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, you know, having that structure in the beginning can be really, really helpful, because it means that it makes it more likely that when we do fall off the wagon, when we do stop, when we do skip a day, that it's cool. Like, we know that we can just pick up and carry on the next day, and it doesn't become this big thing of, oh, I said I would do this and then I didn't, and we start beating ourselves up about it and so on. So I think that was the first part of your question, was how many times have I fallen off, which is loads, and I will continue to do so, and that's cool. But I think the second part of your question, Trevor, was what are my suggestions for getting back on? Is that right, Brett?
Yeah. For example, in the book, there's a great comparison between journaling and exercise, right? Like, no one exercises maybe once every 2 weeks and says, yeah, I really think this is going to make a difference. We want that. It doesn't have to be obviously continuous, but it has to be fairly regular to produce results. So
yes.
In the book, you say a guideline is 3 sessions a week, just like that would be, for most people, a reasonable amount of sessions for some kind of intense physical activity or lifting weights or something. But in this case with journaling, the goal is to stay in touch with ourselves. So how long can you go before you start to kind of lose touch or not pay close enough attention to what's going on inside?
Yeah, again, that's a really, really good question. And I'm very hesitant to give a general answer because obviously everybody is different. You know, again, I would go back to saying that the more frequently you can do it, the better. However, having said that, you know, there's different ways of staying in touch with ourselves. So journaling is one way. Some people also find meditation really helpful. There's lots and lots of different ways. So if that is your goal, and, you know, one thing I would really encourage anyone listening to this to think about if you start a journaling practice, when you start a journaling practice, is, okay, what do I really want to get out of this? Because it can be helpful for multiple things, right? It can be helpful for deepening that relationship with ourselves. It can also be helpful for way more practical things, like if we're working on a big project or if we're facing a big challenge, helping ourselves like stay accountable, stay on track, work through that. So it really depends what your goals are. But yeah, I would say that, again, I would kind of turn this question around for you and say, well, how often do you need to do it to stay connected to yourself? You know yourself best. So what frequency feels like it works for you? And you can play around with it. You can experiment. For me, I find several times a week really helps. But again, you know, going back to the exercise metaphor, right now I'm in the middle. I don't know if you know the insanity workouts.
Yes.
So I'm doing that right now. And like I'm kind of in the last like 2 weeks of it. And there have been some days that I've skipped. And it's cool. I don't skip them entirely, but I just start again the next day and pick up where I left off. Like, obviously, if I was to skip a week or something, that might be different. But I think it's the same. It's like I noticed that when I started getting really hung up on the fact that I'd skipped a day or that I hadn't had time or whatever, then I would feel way, way, way more demotivated than if it was like, okay, you know what? I skipped a day. I'm going to start again tomorrow. That's cool. And then I did it. So I guess it's a way of saying, like, don't try not to get too bogged down in the fact that you have skipped a day or that you haven't done it when you said you wanted to do it, and just decide. I mean, it sounds really simple, but it's like, okay, I'm just going to do it tomorrow. And it's not a big deal. It's cool. This is going to happen. It's not the end of the world. I hope that makes sense, but it's less about kind of beating yourself up about it and more about just accepting it and moving on.
Yeah. And really making the most of every day. And I mean, I know that's a cliche, but I'm so often the wait till next Monday kind of guy. Like, wait till next Monday. I am really going to hit the ground running on Monday. And sometimes, like, you know, if a week gets busy with fitness or something else, I kind of start to develop this attitude like, well, this week is lost, you know? Mm. It's always a week. I would never say, okay, well, February is a lost cause, so wait till March. But, you know, getting up in the morning and saying, I'm going to do the best things I can for self-nurturing, for self-care today, even if yesterday wasn't successful, is a very important mindset that I think I'm still trying to develop. There's always going to be more Mondays, yeah, but Monday's not today. Wait, is Monday is today, actually. But anyway, usually today is not Monday. 6 out of 7 days, that is true. So yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the resistance and how I've been dealing with it. I think a lot of us either get on this path or get back on this path when there's some kind of crisis or some kind of discomfort in life. And there's, you know, a lot of things I've been thinking about lately. And as I want to address them, I understand that journaling is going to be a really important part of it. I know myself enough to know that there will be resistance down the line as life becomes more stable, as life becomes more comfortable. I can say, well, look, I'm doing this self-care thing, this self-nurturing thing, and this self-care thing. So there's all this other stuff that maybe I can ignore. And that's kind of a story that I tell myself. But I want to really stick to journaling from here on out. And one of the ways that I've been fighting or trying to preempt that resistance that I know will be coming down the line is making a habit now with a book by Nathaniel Branden called The Art of Self-Discovery, which sets me on a very clear path, right? There isn't all this mystery about what needs to be done. You go through this book chapter by chapter, you write 12 endings for sentence stems, which is something that we've talked a lot about on the show in the past, especially with Wes Bertrand in our self-esteem series. And that I'm hoping will build a momentum, with that I'm hoping will build a routine following a clear path that when that path comes to an end, I'll be ready to continue on with new methods. And in the book, you give a lot of suggestions for that, and we'll get to that in a minute. But talk a little bit about sentence stems, because I know you mentioned prompts a few times in the book. And what do you think of Brandon's work? Have you gone through it? Did you find it helpful?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Love it. I think I've done his sentence completion like three times or something like that all the way through, and got a huge, huge amount out of it as well. One of the things that I really love about it, and I think this definitely relates to journaling, is that, you know, there's a lot of studies that have been done about how much willpower we have in a day. And the general consensus is we all have a finite amount of willpower that, you know, again, going back to the exercise metaphor, if we work our willpower, we can increase it over time, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things I love about sentence stems is that they remove what researchers call decision fatigue, right? You don't have to decide what you're journaling about today because it's just there. And I think that's great in a way, because the whole point of it, as far as I'm aware anyway, is that it kind of breaks down your intellectual defenses. So as you're repeating the sentence stems, you kind of get past the rational justifications or the intellectual justifications that we walk around with every single day. And you get to the root of, okay, well, what is really going on here? How do I really feel about this? You know, what was really my experience? What story am I telling myself? Which is super, super valuable. So yeah, I love sentence stems. Huge fan of them.
It does take some time to get acclimated to it, I've found. Like, you know, when I started the book, and you're trying to write 12, which in the beginning, it seems like it's going to be impossible. At least it seemed that way to me anyway. And I found myself judging, you know, trying to, as he talks about in the book, go into this trance and access the subconscious more. And I'd write something and I'd judge it. I'd be like, that's not true. Or why would I say that? Or that doesn't make any sense. But as you continue to go through the process, it becomes more comfortable and you can just kind of let things flow. So for me, it's been a great way to start again. I haven't been keeping a regular journal in probably 9 years. And I mean, I do check in with myself every day. I use this program called Evernote. There's always to-do lists that are in the form of checklists. So I'm keeping records. But it's more about the doing, and it hasn't been very much about the thinking or the feeling. And that's what I'm working to change. So springboarding from sentence stems, the entire second part of the book is journal writing ideas. And I thought we could go through, there's like over 30 of them, but I thought we could go through just a few that I found interesting. How about that?
That sounds great. Before we do that, do you mind if we just backtrack slightly? Because sure. I have a little analogy that I would love to share, just because I think the point you raised about getting out of the habit, getting back into the habit, and getting back on the wagon, and the way we think about that, and what you were saying about, because I this resonated with me, because I totally do this too, the whole, you know, I'm going to start again on Monday thing. Even if it's Monday that you've kind of fallen off the wagon, then you're like, okay, it's fine, I'll start again next week.
Right.
It's really, really important and a really common thing. And I wanted to just share a little, I guess, analogy or a little story. And this is not my story. Someone shared this with me, but it really impacted me. So the way that this woman described, you know, good habits and the way that we think about them, and this is another coach called Nicole Antoinette, who runs a site. I think it's called lifelessbullshit.com, but she's really, really cool. She's a great coach. But she shared this analogy, which is like, if you imagine that you have this magic money jar, right? And you have it for a year starting on the 1st of January. And every time you tap this jar, so you can do it once per day, but if you tap this jar every day you'll get a dollar appearing in the jar, or a pound for me. Mm-hmm. So imagine you get to like March and you've been tapping the jar once a day, you've been getting your dollar. And then March, like one of your relatives gets sick and you have to go out of town suddenly and you forget the jar and you leave it at home. So at that point, you have a choice when you get back, which is to say, oh, shoot, you know, I missed 3 days of tapping this jar. So I guess like I'll just leave it now because like I missed 3 days. So it's kind of like there's no point in continuing. Or would you say, okay, well, I missed 3 days, but I still want to make the most of the other like 250 days. So right. I'm going to keep tapping it, right?
Right.
I mean, in that situation, I think like, all of us would be like, oh, well, the second one, obviously, you know, obviously we keep tapping it. But the point that she was making is that when it comes to habits that are really good for us, whether that's exercising or in this case, as we're talking about journaling, you know, every time we journal, we put a metaphorical dollar in our magic money jar because we're doing something that's good for us. And it might not make a huge difference in a single day, but over time, over the space of a year, it's going to make a huge difference. And equally, you know, if you happen to skip 4 or 5 days over the space of a year, it's probably not going to make that much difference. You know, it's the difference between $360 and $365. Whereas if we have the first mindset, that is the difference between $360 and like $50, right?
Yeah.
And so if you think about it in terms of like your emotional well-being or your physical well-being, I just wanted to share that because I thought that was kind of an interesting comparison to how we usually think about these things compared to what is actually the logical, rational way of thinking about them.
I love that. I'm going to keep that in mind the next time I start thinking about the upcoming Monday. That is a great suggestion. So
yeah, I found it super helpful.
Yes. So as far as some journaling suggestions that you give mm-hmm. in the book, I wanted to start with a couple that are more about the present, life as it is now, and then maybe go back to a few that can help us access life as it was, things that we should remember about the past. So life as it is now, the first one that I really like and something that I think is super important is the gratitude journal, which I know can be very helpful during tough times. But what is a gratitude journal?
So a gratitude journal, again, you know, at the risk of repeating myself, it can really be whatever you want it to be. It's one of those things that right now is very en vogue. So a lot of people are talking about keeping a gratitude journal, and it's sort of something that keeps cropping up in those, you know, 5 Habits of Successful CEOs type articles. But, you know, it can be as simple as just at the end of the day, writing down 10 things that you feel grateful for. And, you know, again, a lot of research has been done on this and why it's so powerful. And what studies have shown is that actually it's not necessarily the big things that when we express gratitude for them have the biggest impact on our quality of life. It's actually the really little things. So I could say later today, I felt really grateful for the fact that I went out this morning and just feeling the sun on my skin was just incredible after like a long cold winter, right? Tiny mm-hmm. little things like that. Those little everyday moments that are readily accessible to all of us. But you know, we're so distracted most of the time, we don't even take the time to acknowledge. So it could be as simple as sitting down at the end of the day, writing down 10 things you feel grateful for. It could be expressing gratitude in an unsent letter to somebody else, right? If somebody has had a big impact on you, or maybe it's someone who's just there all the time, nothing particularly profound has happened, but you just really appreciate who they are and the fact that they're there and they're present in your life, right? It could be an unsent letter to someone in that way. But yeah, I mean, again, how you express the gratitude isn't as important if this is a practice that you want to cultivate. How you express it is not as important as just being consistent about it and making time to do it every day, even if it's just 3 things at the beginning of the day from the day before. You know, it can be beginning, end of the day. The how isn't as important as A, the why, and B, how often you do it.
Absolutely. That's gratitude. The second present day awareness journaling activity was the nurture list, where you talked about distinguishing between self-care activities and nurturing activities. And what came to my mind here, two words, really: balance, right? Trying to balance the things we mm-hmm. do to care for ourselves, and the things we do to nurture ourselves, but also overcompensation. I find that I can tell myself that, oh, look at all this self-care stuff that I'm doing. And it can actually find, when I'm more conscious of it, that it's overcompensation for more nurturing activities. So first of all, maybe we could make the distinction just for people who are totally unfamiliar, self-care activities versus nurturing activities.
Sure. So I define self-care activities as things that benefit our physical, mental, and emotional health. And if you think about things that fall under those categories in your own life, they're not always things that are enjoyable. And I think this is where maybe people get a little confused with what self-care is all about sometimes. This self-care is stuff like that feels good in the present moment and is good for us. Sorry, that's self-nurturing. Self-care is activities that are good for us in the long term but don't necessarily feel that great in the short term. So, for example, I am facing an imminent dentist appointment where I'm going to have a wisdom tooth out. I'm not looking forward to this. But it's still a self-care activity because it needs to happen. It's going to be much better than the alternative in the long run. It's still going to kind of suck in the short term.
Right.
So it's still self-care, but it's not fun or particularly pleasant in the short term. Whereas self-nurturing are things that are, they're good for us in the long term, and they are, you know, nurturing, pleasant, fun, enjoyable in the short term as well.
So are we talking about making lists and reviewing them here, essentially, of each and distinguishing between the two?
Yeah, absolutely. And making sure that you have a balance between the two as well, because the self-care activities are very, very important, right? We need them to maintain our health. As I mentioned, you know, our physical, mental, and emotional health, we need those things. However, it's also important to balance them out with self-nurturing activities as well. And so this is where journaling can be really helpful, just because it makes us more conscious of, okay, well, what is on this list for me, right? What self-care activities do I have that I might need to attend to that are really important to attend to? But then how can I balance those activities out that are not going to be so pleasant in the short term, but things that, you know, are going to leave me feeling nurtured in the short term?
Right. So going from present moment to the past, one of the most interesting suggestions, and I remember I read this, I saw this book once in a bookstore, and I bought it. I think it was called like How to Think Like Einstein. It was like a gimmicky coffee table book, but I was like, I want to do that, I think. So it was mostly like these exercises that you could put yourself through to develop new ways of thinking more creatively. And one of the ones, it's actually the first one that you mention in Journal Writing Ideas, dominant and non-dominant hands. So obviously we just write with our dominant hand, but people don't really think about what we might be able to tap into by using our non-dominant hand. And you suggest that this can actually help people access that inner child and his or her emotions, right?
Yeah, so I was really curious about this idea, and the reason I included it in the book is that, again, I read research that showed that, in general, like, it's a very different experience for people, and literally it lights up different areas of our brain when we write with our left hand as opposed to our right hand, especially if our left hand is our non-dominant hand. You know, for some people, it might be their right hand is a non-dominant hand, but it's a very, very different experience. It's also a very different emotional experience as well, and research has suggested, anyway, that it can take us back to that time, you know, around the age of kind of 4, 5, 6, when we were learning to write, and that it sort of helps us tap into experiences from that time. That might be the case. When it comes to any of this stuff, I hesitate to say that it's going to be the case for everyone and make that generalization. I think everyone's going to have a slightly different experience of it, but it's still a really, really interesting exercise to try, just because it, you know, it is reminiscent at that time. And it also, I found for me anyway, doing that, it also brings up a lot around communication and what it feels like not to be able to communicate properly. You know, if it's a little bit kind of frustrating writing with my left hand because I use my right hand for everything else. It's just generally a really, really interesting experience. But yeah, it can be really, really helpful for getting back in touch with, you know, this part of ourselves that we call the inner child. And just on that note, something I would say is that I don't know if your listeners, are your listeners familiar with internal family systems at all?
Internal family systems. I know a little bit about it. Again, I've heard Daniel Mackler talk about it. But if you want to, yeah, certainly you could provide a definition for those who are unfamiliar.
Sure. So this is very much the amateur Cliff Notes version of what it is. I'll just give you that caveat. But it's basically the idea that when we talk about ourselves or personalities, we generally in society talk about them as being a single entity, right? I am Hannah, you are Brett. But actually, when we think about the actual day-to-day experience that we have of living with ourselves and of experiencing other people as well, we actually have multiple parts to our personality. You know, people talk about things like the voices in our heads as being, you know, something that is kind of a joke or something that is in the realm of people who are struggling with mental illness and so on and so forth. But actually, it's a sign of mental health. And that's what internal family systems is all about, is it's a framework and a paradigm through which you can get to know these different parts of your personality and get to know essentially the different voices in your head. And the great thing about this dominant and non-dominant hand exercise is that it's one way of doing that, right? It can be a way of expressing that inner child part that you mentioned, that part of us that is still inside us and still comes out in certain situations. Like you mentioned the word tantrum earlier. I don't know about you, but I've definitely had experiences where I've had emotional reactions to things that have totally not been warranted in the present situation, right?
Right. Yeah.
I've just been like completely flooded with emotion when it's like someone just makes a comment, which is they didn't even mean it to be a bad thing. It's completely innocuous. You know, silly situations like that where afterwards you're just like, what the hell was that about? Like, why did I get so upset about that? And that is usually, you know, not always, but it's usually an inner child thing, right? It's reminding us of something from our past. It's taking us back to a time when we were, you know, in childhood, when someone did something or said something to us that really hurt us, really cut us very deeply. And so this kind of exercise can be useful for getting back in touch with that part of us, which is still inside us. Like, we're still carrying those memories, we're still carrying around those experiences. And as you said earlier, give that part of the voice as well.
Yeah. Later in the book, you talk about these three parts, the inner child, ourselves as the adult, and also this parent, which is that us as a parent or our parents?
It is us, but often the parental voice is something that we have internalized.
Yes.
So it's almost like a replica of, but it is still us.
Yeah.
Again, this is a framework that comes from a type of therapy called transactional analysis. There's a couple of very famous books that were written about it, which if this sort of resonates with you and the way that you think about yourself, I really recommend checking it out. The first is called Games People Play, which is by Eric Byrne. And the second book is I'm Okay, You're Okay. I can't remember who that's by, but they're both about transactional analysis, which breaks down, and it's essentially a companion to the IFS system, and it breaks down the different parts of ourselves into three categories. So the parent, the child, and the adult.
So,
and the ideal is that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
The transactional analysis?
Yes.
Okay.
Which sounds really unfun, but it's actually really interesting.
Yeah. There's obviously one of the things that we're trying to reconcile to these characters or these voices are often in quite a bit of conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where transactional analysis where I found it especially helpful is looking at dynamics in relationships. So there are certain relationships that we will all find ourselves in where I don't know if you've had this experience, I certainly have, where I just feel like I'm 9 years old again, and I feel it doesn't matter what the person says or does, just feel like a small child, and I feel like everything that comes out of my mouth is just ridiculous, and I can't seem to like string a coherent sentence together in front of this person. And there's usually something that has happened there where I have gone into quote child mode and they are in parent mode, right? There's a certain like shift in the dynamic of the relationship that happens. It can also happen the other way around. For example, if someone does something that I find a little triggering, I might want to start saying to them like, well, you shouldn't do that. Why don't you do it this way instead? And that is me getting into parent mode. And everybody's, you know, child, parent, adult mode will look slightly different. But often what we end up doing is, as I just mentioned, is that we end up replicating certain aspects of our parents, for example, when we're in parental mode, or we end up replicating certain aspects of ourselves when we were children. So like I mentioned earlier, you know, getting really, really upset about something, about a seemingly innocuous comment, or something that was meant well, but maybe not, you know, said quite in the most sensitive way, or something like that, right? That is me replicating aspects of myself as a child. And the ideal, there can be positive interactions between when someone's in parent mode and then someone's in child mode. But in general, you know, one of the quote good dynamics that have in relationships is adult to adult, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's equal. So there's a time and a place for parent to child, or adult to child and so on. But in general, adult to adult is how we want to be relating most of the time.
Absolutely. You know, as far as dealing or really not dealing with, I should say, probably nurturing would be a better word for this inner child. There's a suggestion for journaling ideas that goes along with dominant and non-dominant hands. And you sum it up as dealing with upset and worry, where the inner child is triggered and starts maybe dominating that dynamic of the group of selves. And what we want to try to do is essentially write the balance by creating in a journal a dialogue between that child and not a judgmental adult, which is so often the case, but a nurturing adult. The suggestion that you gave that I thought was interesting is that you write using your dominant hand for the adult and the non-dominant hand for the child.
Yeah, I'm really glad. What I found really interesting about this and useful myself is that in terms of connecting with those different parts, and the important thing to remember, and this was, it might sound really obvious in retrospect, but it was kind of a revelation for me, was that even when we're feeling really flooded by an emotion, so really overwhelmed by a particular feeling, really upset or really angry or really frustrated or stuck in that spiral of negativity that we can get in sometimes, where it just feels like, you know, we start finding ourselves saying things like everything is going wrong, right? Nothing is going well.
Right.
That's usually a sign when we start using big words like all or nothing language,
yeah,
that we're stuck, that a particular part is dominating, and it's not especially help. There is definitely, we need to give that part a chance to express itself for sure, but it's not especially helpful for us in that moment to have that part dominating in terms of, okay, well, what am I going to do next? And so this, I found this exercise really, really helpful, especially in the beginning, just for learning to almost separate out those parts of myself and realize that even if I'm feeling particularly flooded by a particular part, you know, my inner mentor or my inner adult, my inner parent, you know, good parent, however you want to describe it for yourself, that part is still in there. It's just that it's kind of being flooded by the other part right now. And so it can really, really help when you're in the middle of a really challenging situation to remember that it's not that this is you, full stop. This is just a part of you that is really dominant right now. And separating out the two parts by using different hands to sort of express what they might say in that situation and almost like role play it can be a really, really helpful way, especially if you're just getting used to this idea of identifying the different parts of your internal dialogue, of separating those two out.
Absolutely. The only other one that I want to talk about that we, even though there are over 30, we did already discuss a little bit, but I just want to reiterate its importance as a getting started exercise, and that was prompts. Sentence completion mm-hmm. would be a great example of that. So I do have The Art of Self-Discovery right in front of me, and it's organized by chapters, with each chapter having basically a theme for exploration. And I'm sorry, bear with me. I'm just looking for the table of contents here. So it would be things like exploring the influence of our parents, our inner child and teenage selves, exploring negative emotions, exploring positive emotions, exploring sexuality, self-esteem, and the sage self. So that's how the book is organized. And then, you know, I'm just flipping to the teenager within. So an older mm-hmm. version of the child self. And the prompts are things like, when I became a teenager, and then you try to write 12 endings, when I was 14 years old, when I was 16 years old, when I entered high school, with my teenage friends, I felt, with the opposite sex, I felt. If the teenager within could speak, he or she might say, what? So prompts, I think, are a really, really great way, for me anyway, to get started or restart. But essentially what you're providing in the second part of the book, they're all prompts in what do I do with this pen or paper or my fingers and this keyboard or this voice recorder. It's all kind of serving the same purpose, right? It's providing some kind of direction for where to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the Art of Self-Discovery was, I think, the best foot forward for me initially to restart that. And I just wanted to wrap up today by discussing the final part of the book, where you talk about retrospecting. And this was the question that I had, you know, for myself when I looked at this journal that I kind of walked away from 2005, 2006. What do I do with this? Like, I wrote all this, but is it going to be useful to me 10 years later? Or how would it have been useful to me really a week after I wrote it 10 years ago? When we're trying to make the journals that we're keeping useful in the future, whether we're talking about 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, 5 years, what are we trying to do? What's that all about?
So there's lots of different things that you can do. And again, this is where, you know, journaling can really be whatever you want it to be. So retrospecting, which I'm pretty sure is not a real word, I just made it up, I think, but that's the word that I use for it anyway. You know, it can be useful for example, if you're looking back at a journal that you wrote in 2005, for practicing empathy for yourself, which again is a really important skill that very few of us are taught. Yeah. In fact, most of us are taught the opposite, right?
Yeah.
It's really helpful for that, for just really practicing your empathy skills. It can be even useful for doing something like practicing active listening, you know, really reading between the lines and thinking like, oh, I wonder what was going on for me when I was reading this, and all of that really, really important stuff, which is a good skill to have for our relationship with ourselves in the present and our relationships with other people. It can also be helpful for back and noticing certain patterns that were cropping up, right? So maybe patterns that you weren't super aware of at the time, but if you notice that you keep like trash talking yourself, or using specific phrases in relation to yourself, or labeling yourself in a certain way, even if you weren't conscious about it at the time, when you go back with that distance, it's almost like you're reading it, something that was written by someone else. And it means that you're a lot more objective about it. You're a lot more able to spot those patterns. And then again, you know, it gives you a platform or a springboard from which you can reflect in your present day life. Well, do I still do this? And why do I do this? And what's the alternative? And, you know, what do I think would be different about my life if I didn't do this anymore, or if I didn't think in this way, or if I, you know, I can see from reading this journal that I'm really struggling to know how to deal with feeling frustrated. So is that still an issue for me today? You know, or if it isn't, what helped with that? And just, it gives you that kind of extra layer. It helps you get a layer deeper with your self-knowledge and your self-awareness. But the most helpful thing I found with retrospecting in terms of that question, well, what do I do with this, is always try and bring it back to you today.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, whatever happened in the past, like, it's happened, it's done. Obviously, you can't, you know, you can't go back and change it. So the most helpful thing that you can do is to take the information that you can see, and this is why it's really helpful to leave a gap between writing the entry and reading it. It doesn't have to be 10 years, as in your case, but just a few months, so that you can go back and you can have that learning experience. You can start recognizing those patterns. You can start reading between the lines and looking for things that you couldn't see before just because you were too deep in the experience. And then thinking, okay, well, how does this impact my life today? What can I learn from this? What can I take away from this? And it's a really, you know, in a sort of quite hippy-dippy way, it's a really beautiful way of kind of working with yourself as well. And again, you know, just appreciating, you were talking about gratitude journals earlier, just really experiencing gratitude for the fact that, you know, some of the experiences that you went through in the past might not have been very nice. They might have been pretty challenging, but they were such a gift in the sense that you can now learn from them, and you can now kind of move forward older, wiser, and, you know, really feel that gratitude for yourself for making those journals back then and writing down everything and being willing to kind of share with you your future self as you are today.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe even going back to it with a list of questions, whether it's, you mentioned a couple of like a good markers, like start of a year would be a good time to review. Your birthday would be a good time to review if we're talking about larger timescale. But even if it was just every week, every month, and for, of course, longer periods of time, who were the key players in my life? Is there still processing to do over these events that I wrote about that I was trying to process in the moment, and not doing it to dwell on things that were difficult, but returning to those things from the future with a curious and open mind. And of course, very importantly, especially the further back we're going, empathy for ourselves in that time, which is not taught to us, is not really modeled for us in school, and it's all more judgment and domination oriented. So we tend to, I think, internalize that mindset very much when we're looking back at our past selves. This is kind of embarrassing. I was telling this story to a friend, like sometimes the subconscious just fires this shot into my consciousness about this past memory that could have been college, which was, you know, for me at this point, 15 plus years ago, or my teenage years, or even my childhood. And it will just be like so uncomfortable and cringeworthy that I've actually started to sing or make noise to get it out of my head, to tamp it down. And now I'm kind of in a place where when that shot is fired, I try to catch it and say, okay, it's uncomfortable, it's prickly, but I'll hold it for a second and I'll see what it is and I'll see how it feels and I'll think about why it got fired into the consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll think about something that I said or something that I did, especially in college where so frequently inhibitions were turned way down and you know, something crazy happened or something uncomfortable happened. And it is a cringe, and then it is like a distracting song. So not a lot of empathy there. It's like, oh my goodness, that was me, is more the feeling. And that's judgment, right? And it's dismissal and it's dissociation. That's something that I think through having a regular process, like keeping a journal, especially when so many of the exercises are geared towards recognizing, remembering, and empathizing with that person, that becomes an easier and easier thing to do. And it's healthy to do.
Absolutely. And just going back to what you said, you know, again, repeating something that I said earlier, when we have those moments, one of the big kind of epiphanies for me around this, because I can totally relate to what you're saying, and I've done my fair share of kind of cringeworthy or facepalm inducing things.
Right.
When I get that subconscious shot, I'm just like, oh God, yeah, I've forgotten about that. And it feels like ignorance is bliss, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that the big kind of epiphany for me around those things was like, okay, that was really embarrassing. So again, I wonder what, that's not me, that's a part of me. And I'm aware to some people that might sound like, you know, a self-justification or whatever. And I don't think about it in that way. I think about it more as a tool for understanding myself better.
Yeah.
Not for, you know, making excuses or anything like that. I think self-ownership is a really important part of growing up and an important part of this journaling process that we're talking about in the self-awareness as well, like owning the stuff that we've done and taking responsibility for it. But just remembering, like, that was a part of me. So what was that part needing when I did that?
Yeah.
Like, if you think about, you know, the really awkward or cringeworthy or, you know, even like lacking integrity or mean or, you know, the stuff that we're less than proud of, which we all have, even if we think about those things, it's like, what was I trying to do there? What was I really trying to do? When I look back now with the gift of hindsight and everything I know about myself and everything I know about myself since then, what need was I trying to meet with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that can be a really, really valuable process.
Yes.
It is a really valuable process.
Yeah, you know, that being said, great way to finish, language. Right. And one of the things, the language that we use, what does it mean and what does it reveal when we journal or when we write about those experiences, maybe as they happened or our judgments about those experiences later, if we're doing something more reflective. I have gone back to journals with a pen and a highlighter. And one of the things that I realized I could be paying more attention to in the retrospecting process is word choice. Mm-hmm. Am I using judgmental words to describe things I did, to describe other people, to describe how I was feeling about myself when reflecting upon it? And you mention in the book nonviolent communication. And it is at first a bit of a choppy and awkward thing to try with other people, but it is a really beneficial way of speaking to ourselves first and foremost. And also, like, I think mediating a bit with that inner critic. So you talk about evaluating word choices, as Marshall Rosenberg said, is this jackal, the mean, judgmental, or is it giraffe, friendly, empathetic, right? So language can reveal a lot when we're doing retrospecting.
Definitely. And the really interesting thing about language is that often when we choose certain words, especially in the heat of a moment, you know, if we're And I don't mean to make it sound like we always journal when we're upset. I would say that's usually, as you said, what prompts us to start. But journaling can be fun, too. It doesn't have to always be, like, heavy and serious and devastating and, you know, something that we do in the midst of turmoil. It can be fun, too. So I just want to sort of insert that little tangent there. But, you know, our word choice says so much, again, that we're not even really aware of in the moment. And so, like you said, it can be really useful to go back and look at, okay, well, how am I talking about myself, and how am I talking about this person? You know, if we're talking about other people, like what beliefs am I expressing through my choice of words here? What does this say about, you know, what state I'm in? What does this say about my view about the world? Has anything changed since then? Again, going back to those questions of, like, is anything different? If so, what's changed? Do I feel differently about this now? And if not, like, well, how can I use this knowledge that in the last, you know, 2 months to 10 years, however long it is, that nothing's changed in this regard? Like, what do I want to do about that? But the language is so, so key. And it's something that, again, it can, like you said about nonviolent communication, it can feel kind of a little bit odd to pay attention to the language in that level of detail. I mean, I did an English degree, so maybe I'm sort of more used to it than other people who don't have that kind of background, just because I've sort of been trained to think that way. But it's just such a useful thing to do. It's worth going through that uncomfortable beginner stage just to really think, you know, if you see that you've written something about yourself, or you've labeled yourself in a particular way, if you were to sit back and think, well, how would I feel if somebody else said that to me? Or would I say that to my best friend?
Yeah.
Right? And if not, why not? And that can be a really good starting point for exploring, okay, well, why am I talking about myself or about other people in certain ways? Why am I talking, you know, I notice that I'm always talking about situations in a really negative way. What is that about? You know, that just those little nuances of things that feel like at the time they're really innocuous and we probably don't even pay attention to can be a real goldmine of information later on.
Yeah. And we're talking about language, which is obviously written. But one more thing here to add to that. A listener named Alan asks if your journaling is purely text driven, or do you draw? Do you use other forms of imagery? Because obviously using other methods of expression could also reveal quite a bit, for sure.
Definitely. And in the book, I have a little section on art journaling. I've experimented with art journaling in the past. My strong suit is writing, though. I mean, what I would say to people listening to this is that this is not a reason not to do it. But for me, it's just a question of, like, I'm a terrible artist. Like, I can barely draw a stick man, and I don't particularly enjoy it either. So for me, it feels like I am going to be able to meet that need for self-expression a lot better through writing.
Right.
I do dabble in it occasionally, and there are some really great art journaling workshops that I've been to and exercises that I've done, which have been very powerful. And I include a couple of exercises in the book, which are geared to people who feel more comfortable expressing themselves visually. And again, something I talk about is that if writing is not your thing, because it's not everybody's, and I totally get that, and if art is not your thing either, you know, another way you can do it is by recording voice memos, and that can be really useful for recording things like dreams that you have, for example, when it's like 2 a.m. and you don't have the energy to pick up a pen. You can also record stuff. You know, pretty much every smartphone you can get now has a voice recorder built in. It's not... you don't have to get any special equipment or anything like that. It's really, really easy to do. So there's lots and lots of different ways that you can do it. But again, I would really encourage you to think for yourself and think about yourself and think, well, how do I feel most comfortable expressing myself? What gives me the best outlet for expressing myself and for really connecting to myself in that way? And just because other methods of communication or other formats don't feel comfortable is not a reason why you shouldn't try them.
Right.
But just experiment and see what works for you. So the short answer to your question is yes, I do it occasionally. It's not my preferred way of doing it, but there's definitely, definitely, definitely value in it. So if you're curious about it, I highly recommend trying it out.
Right. Whatever method gives you, or whoever we're talking about, I guess the running start that is needed to make a routine or a habit out of doing this. And the book has endless suggestions for doing that. Well, not endless, but, you know, almost 50. And the title, again, is The Ultimate Guide to Journaling. How can people get a copy?
It is on all major ebook outlets. So it's on Amazon. You can get it from iBooks and Kobo and Barnes and the Nook for Barnes and Noble as well. And on Amazon, you can also download the audiobook, which is narrated by Stephanie Murphy, former host of Pork Therapy.
Yes.
And she does a great job of narrating it. So that's a nice addition.
Yes, I just listened last night and I thought it was lovely. And I got a lot out of it. So I really appreciate you putting all that information out there. And of course, your website is becomingwhoyouare.net, which I also encourage people to visit. Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so helpful for me, and I'm sure for many others as well. And as I dig more into your site, I'm thinking there's probably more that we could talk about. So I would love to have you back sometime.
That would be great, Brett. Thank you so much. And yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about my work, but especially about journaling. And it's been so useful for me. I'm just always grateful for an opportunity to kind of spread the word and hopefully encourage and inspire other people to try it for themselves. So thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.